Be strong and courageous. When we hear that phrase and we start thinking Bible, we think Joshua, right? And we should. Because five times as Joshua follows God's battle plan, the idea that we must be strong and courageous comes up. But keep in mind, we find the same theme in Moses' time when he was given his parting words in Deuteronomy chapter 31. He tells the Israelites they have to be strong and courageous. It resurfaces twice in 1 Chronicles as David passes the kingdom to Solomon. David tells his son, be strong and courageous. Again in 2 Chronicles chapter 32 verse 7, as Hezekiah charged the military officers who would defend Jerusalem, be strong and courageous. God posed the question to Ezekiel in chapter 22, verse 14, that asked Ezekiel, are you strong and courageous? And even when Paul was talking to the church at Corinth, he asked the church in Corinth in 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verses 13 through 14, to be strong and courageous. So we've been doing this sermon series, Following the Donkey, and we started off with Abraham, and I'm promising you, I've got this figured out. Really, I did. By the time we finish this sermon series, we will be setting on Easter Sunday. Okay? So we've got it all lined up. But when we come to this theme of strong and courageous, we're pretty sure donkeys are physically strong, right? They're pack animals. They have to be, right? So we take them and we put all of our stuff on them. We use cars these days, but then when you're going to go out where the car can't go, you can take a donkey and put all of your stuff on it, and he can carry it because he's physically strong. Did you know that they have strong vision? Have you ever noticed when a donkey walks, he kind of walks with his head sort of down, never up like this? And the reason is because the way the donkey's eyes are shaped when they walk with his head down, he can see all 4 feet at the same time when he walks, which I think is incredible because oftentimes I can't even see the two that I have. But he can see all 4 feet because of the way his vision works. We usually think of donkeys as kind of quiet creatures. No, they have a very strong voice. A donkey's bray can be heard up to 60 miles away in the desert. And you thought your kids could scream. Well, the donkey, when he needs to be heard, he can be heard. And as far as his mind, well, donkeys are very clever. They have a keen sense of curiosity, and they are not what we call stubborn. But they can be reluctant to do anything that might be considered unsafe to them. They like to consider situations before deciding what to do. And of course, we know donkeys have strong balance. With that great physical strength and with that ability to see exactly where they're going to put every single foot at the same time, they are one of the most nimble creatures on the planet. They can go through tough terrain and tricky terrain that would normally make most animals go lame. So they're strong. But are they courageous? I mentioned a couple of weeks ago that you can actually train a donkey to be over top of a flock. They'll look over a flock or a herd, and they will protect that herd. However, think about a horse. Usually we think horses are noble steeds, right? Compared to a horse, donkeys show a limited response to fear, pain, and illness. They are stoic animals, rarely panic, and may even appear catatonic when in stress. When faced with a potential threat, donkeys determine to plant their feet while they analyze the situation. All too often, again, donkeys are misdiagnosed as stubborn, when really they are just likely experiencing fear, and they think before they act. So today we're going to continue to follow the donkey through Scripture to Easter, and we want to look at an individual that showed great strength and great courage. So if you want to grab a copy of God's Word, I'll be in 1 Samuel chapter 25, and we're going to start in verses 7 through 8, and this is a David story, sort of. Now, I hear that it is sheep shearing time. When your shepherds were with us, we did not mistreat them, and the whole time they were at Carmel, nothing of theirs was missing. Ask your own servants, and they will tell you. Therefore, be favorable toward my men, since we come at a festive time. Please give your servants and your son David whatever you can find for them." So David is not exactly the subject of this particular sermon, because this is not a David and Goliath story. There's no donkey with David and Goliath, so it didn't qualify to come into this particular sermon. However, at this point, David is living with his men out in the wilderness. He's been ordained king, and he is the rightful heir to the throne, but right now he is being pursued by Saul, because Saul has decided, "I don't want to give up the throne." So he's chasing David through the wilderness, and so David, being the entrepreneur he is, he sets up his own business. David becomes a security guard, of all things. And him and his men are living out in the desert, and they have worked out arrangements with the shepherds that come out there and use the wilderness and the area to basically protect their flocks. And so they are doing this, and now it's a festival time, and they're coming to this guy named Nabal, and they are asking Nabal, basically, "Time to pay the bill, guy. We've been out there protecting your flocks. We've been out there looking after your servants, and now it's a festival time, and we need food and supplies." And so David is asking for what he should have been getting all along. And, well, as the story begins to unfold, we get four very distinct responses from what David's request is. And the first one, we get a very foolish response. I'm in verses 10 and 11. Nabal answered David's servants, "Who is this David? Who is the son of Jesse? My servants are breaking away from their master." Many servants are breaking away from their master these days. "Why should I take my bread and water and the meat I have slaughtered for my shearers and give it to men coming from who knows where?" So Nabal decides, "David, I'm not going to pay you. As a matter of fact, I'm not even real sure who you are. I'm not even real sure that this is all legitimate. For all I know, you're supposed to be Saul's slave, and you're just running around now doing things you shouldn't. So I'm not going to pay you." And, well, David doesn't take kindly to those words. And if you know anything about David, he is not the stoic donkey. He is more of the reactive horse. And so David hears the message, and David gives us a fighting response. This is what he says in verses 12 through 13. "David's men turned around and went back. When they arrived, they reported every word David said to his men. Each of you, strap on your sword." So they did, and David strapped on his as well. About 400 men went up with David, while 200 stayed with the supplies. So the servants come back to David and look at David, and they say, "Nabal ain't going to pay us. In fact, not only is he not going to pay us, he kind of insulted you, David. And he thinks that maybe you're just a runaway slave, and he's not going to pay us." And David said, "I can fix this. We're going to go to war. We're going to go and we're going to take what is rightfully ours that we have earned." And he has every right to do this. I mean, he's earned this. He's provided the services that he said he was going to provide. Think about the idea. If you went into work tomorrow at the end of the week, and you got to the end of the week, and your employer looked at you and said, "You're not getting paid this week." "Yeah, I saw some, them's fighting words, folks. Would you come back the next week?" "Probably not if you're not going to pay me." Because we go to work to get paid, and you know what? David said, "I'm going to take what's rightfully mine." And the thing is that when Nabal was hearing from David's servants, some of Nabal's servants were overhearing the conversation, and they had a response also, and I think it's a very good response. They know David. They've heard the stories. They know about everything that's happening. And so they give a very fearful response to what David is about to have, what Nabal had told him. And they go to Nabal's wife. Her name is Abigail. Here's a good lesson. If you can't solve the problem with the husband, just go talk to the wife, okay? You'll probably get your problem solved. I'm in verses 14 through 17, and this is what the servants say to Abigail. "One of the servants told Abigail, Nabal's wife, 'David sent messengers from the wilderness to give our master his greetings, but he hurled insults at them. Yet these men were very good to us. They did not mistreat us, and the whole time we were in the field near them, nothing was missing. Night and day, They were a wall around us the whole time we were herding our sheep near them. Now think it over and see what you can do. Because disaster is hanging over our master and his whole household. He is such a wicked man that no one can talk to him. So the servants heard this and they're like, this isn't going to end well for us, okay? Because David is a man that can be a very violent individual, and David is a man of war. And so you're not going to pay David, and you insult him. He's going to show up here, and understand, he's got 400 fighting men. Well, actually, he's got 600, but he's got to leave some behind to kind of take care of camp, right? They're coming, Abigail. What can you do? And it's actually not David, not Nabal, or not the servants that give us our strong and courageous response. It is none other than Abigail. Verses 18 through 20, this is what Abigail did. Abigail acted quickly. She didn't sit around and ponder it. She didn't think, well, I don't know, you know, maybe tomorrow. Let's think about it. Let's have a committee meeting about it. No, this woman is like, Abigail acted quickly. She took 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 dressed sheep, 5 seahs of roasted grain, 100 cakes of raisin, 200 cakes of pressed figs, and loaded them on, there they are, donkeys. Then she told her husband Nabal, but she did not tell her husband, excuse me, I skipped a line. Then she told her servants, go ahead, I will follow you, but she did not tell her husband Nabal. As she came riding her donkey into the mountain ravine, there were David and his men descending toward her, and she met them. And I realize everybody's in a panic right now. I'll never get all those blanks filled in. Don't worry, I got it figured out. You can copy while I tell you about this particular moment. Think about what Abigail was doing. 400 soldiers against 1 lady and 7 donkeys. Those don't sound like good odds, do they? If I was going to go into battle, I don't think I would go 400 armed men, 1 lady, and 7 donkeys armed with food. I mean, I know an army travels on its stomach, but that's a little bit ridiculous, okay? So you understand what she is about to do is a desperation move. But she's thought it over. Look at the size of what she's bringing. 200 loaves of bread. And I'm not talking about the little loaves you get at Walmart. I mean, these would have been great big cakes of freshly baked bread. 2 skins of wine. And before you misconstrue that and think she brought them 2 little bottles of wine, that's not what the skins were. The skins were, they would literally take an animal like a goat and they would skin it all in one piece and stitch up the sides and dry it. And they would make saddlebags that would have covered both sides of the donkey. So 2 skins would have been a skin on each side, full length of the donkey, full width of the donkey, filled to the brim. So it's kind of like more like she's bringing David a few kegs of wine, not just a few bottles. 5 dressed sheep. No, she didn't put bow ties and coats on them. These were dressed sheep. They had been slaughtered and prepared and were ready to eat. This was a meal that was on the go. 5 seahs of roasted grain, in case you're wondering. That's about 7.5 to 10 bushels of grain that she's bringing David's men. 100 cakes of raisins. So this would have been kind of like a fig, kind of like a power bar. This would have been something that had been pressed together. It was almost like a little cake that you would just pick up. And again, it was on the go and very useful for military men because raisins can travel. And then, of course, you got to have dessert. So she brought 200 cakes of pressed figs. So great big fig Newtons, I guess. I'm not really sure what a pressed fig looks like, but that's what she brought. But she wasn't done because that's only 6 donkeys. What did she put on the second, on the 7th donkey? Herself. She isn't just sending her servants to go and deal with this. She isn't saying, fine, we'll send you the payment and maybe he'll call. She's going to take care of this herself. And as she's going, we have to ask some important questions. Was she doing wrong in this without doing it without her husband's knowledge? And by biblical standards, absolutely, positively. What she was doing was completely wrong and could have meant that when she got back home, Nabal could have put her to death and nobody would have cared. Interesting. You see, remember, we're not talking about modern times. We're talking about biblical culture here, and it was different from what we think. And so she was a female, and so what she was doing was absolutely outrageous, that she was going to cut her husband out the picture, go around her husband, and offer all of this food without her husband. The thing is, the other question we have to ask was David obligated to relent? And this may surprise you. Absolutely not. In fact, she could have showed up with her servants and all this food, and by biblical law, David could have, he could have just killed them all, taken the stuff, and then went after the ball. So David could have had his, I guess, cakes and eat them too, right? He could have had all the stuff and still gotten his vengeance. So I want you to think about what Abigail was doing. If she succeeds, while her family was saved, she could die. If she fails, well, she may die. Her actions make her either an intercessor or possibly a sacrifice. One way or the other, Abigail better make sure she makes all the right moves. Now, the easy solution for Abigail would have been to do what? Servants come to Abigail and say, your foolish husband just basically ticked off one of the most angry men that's out there. He's got all these people. He's got all these supplies. He's coming. Run. Flee. Gather your kids. Gather whatever you can get together. Maybe you take the donkeys you've loaded and you head the other way. You're thinking, you know what? Destruction is about to happen. And you know, as you look at that list of what she gathered, there's a pile of symbolism in that entire list, but that's not what she's doing. She's not trying to do something symbolic. She is actually doing what needs to be done. This is why, while the gifts were massive and what was rightfully owed David, in order to get what she's after, well, the important part of that gift was she offered herself. I'm in verses 23 through 31 of the story, and this is how it went down when Abigail met David. When Abigail saw David, she quickly got off her donkey and bowed down before David with her face to the ground. She fell at his feet and said, pardon your servant, my lord, and let me speak to you. Hear what your servant has to say. Please pay no attention, my lord, to that wicked man, the ball. He is just like his name. His name means fool, and folly goes with him. As for me, your servant, I did not see the men my lord sent. And now, my lord, as surely as the Lord your God lives, and you live, since the Lord has kept you from bloodshed and from avenging yourself with your own hands, may your enemies and all who are intent on harming you, on harming my lord, be like the ball. And let this gift, which your servant has brought to my lord, be given to the men who follow you. Please forgive your servant's presumption. The Lord your God will certainly make a lasting dynasty for my lord, because you fight the Lord's battle, and no wrongdoing will be found in you as long as you live. Even though someone is pursuing you, to take your life. The life of my lord will be bound securely in the bundle of the living by the Lord your God. But the lives of your enemies he will hurl from a pocket of a sling. Tell me she don't know her history. When the Lord has fulfilled my lord every good thing he promised concerning all he has appointed him ruler over Israel, my lord will not have on his conscience the staggering burden of needless bloodshed, for having avenged himself. And when the Lord your God has brought my Lord success, remember your servant. I want to tell you something. This is a very smart lady. She knew exactly what she needed to do. And when she arrived, this was not a negotiation. She didn't get off that donkey and say, tell you what, David, we owed you this much. Look, I brought you everything we owed you. I even threw in a little bonus for your men. So tell you what, since we're paying you off, why don't you just take the swords and all the men and just go back and enjoy the skins of wine and enjoy the bread and enjoy all the stuff and just go home and let's just call it a day. Let's just call it even Stephen. That's not what she did. It says she climbed off that donkey and she started out in humility. She got off quickly and she bowed down even to the point where she placed her face right at David's feet. She knew why she had come. She wasn't paying David off. She requested mercy. She looked at David and she said, "You're going to have to show us some mercy because I didn't hear what your servants came to ask. I didn't hear what was going on. I didn't understand it all. And my husband, he's a fool. Because understand, my servants told me that you did the services and we owe you the pay." She's looking for mercy. And in her speech, she acknowledges David's authority. Did you pay really close attention to it? She acknowledged David was indeed the ordained king of Israel, even though Saul was sitting on the throne. And she never calls him by his name. But 11 times as she sits there talking to David, she references him as my Lord. That's impressive. I mean, if you want to get to male ego, that's a really good way to do it. She's coming in, she's saying, "I owe you not only this, I understand you are the future king. I understand what you have done for our nation when you killed Goliath. I understand all of the things that I've heard about you. And I am proclaiming you as authority." And you know, maybe she just was a really good talker, speech maker. But remember, she's doing all of this on the fly. I mean, she gets the news, and she's got to do exactly what she needs to do. And she doesn't have a lot of time to sit down and say, "Let me make a really good speech that's going to work this out." This is a woman that understood what it means to be humble and request mercy. How far did she go? Ultimately, she did not place her life in the hands of David. Did you pay really close attention to her speech? She placed her life in the hands of David's God. She made sure when she referenced this man who always said he worshiped God and he served God and God was first, "Yes, I understand, David, you've been wronged. And I understand, David, you have every right to do what you're about to do. But I want you to stop for a second and think about your God." And she reminds David, "Your God is a living God. He's not a statue. He's not something carved from stone. He's not something that somebody made up. He's not a fairy tale. He is a living, breathing being who is also an eternal God." She talks about David's lasting dynasty. Interesting. She's playing the card here. Somehow she knew God had made a promise to David that your kingdom is never going to end. It's going to be forever and ever. And understand, you've got eternity to figure all of this out, David. But for right now, you need to remember your God. He's the eternal God. And David, that job that you've been doing of protecting the sheep, you need to remember something. Your God is a protective God. She's talking about him hurling David's enemies away. I want you to think about this for a second. Do you really think, with all of the armor he was wearing, that one little rock swung here and put through the air would kill a fully armed man? What do you think happened? God put a little juice behind the rock, don't you think? I can almost see it in the background. When the rock hits, God just takes his fist and goes boom, and just boom, drives it right in. The battle is over. You understand, David? God has been protecting you all these years. I'm just reminding you. And this God that you say you worship, he's a faithful God. I mean, he's made you all of these promises, and look, he's fulfilled every single one of the promises. David, that's your God. But David, I want to make sure you understand who your God really is. The God you worship, he's a merciful God. Talk about a lady that knows how to put it right where it needs to be. David, I am asking mercy from you, but understand, I am asking mercy from your God. How many times does she say, don't do this by your own hands. Don't shed blood just to avenge yourself. Think about who your God is. And if your God was the person standing right here today, looking at me, and what he and I asked this of him, would your God give me mercy? Again, I'm impressed by this lady. I mean, she came up with this while she's riding down the road on a donkey. What am I going to say? And she got there, and she knew exactly where to go. She acknowledged who David was as a person, but more importantly, she acknowledged who David was as a child of God. And you know what? Mission accomplished. In verses 32 through 35, David said to Abigail, praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel, who has sent you today to meet me. May you be blessed for your good judgment and for keeping me from bloodshed this day, from avenging myself by my own hands. Otherwise, as surely as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, who has kept me from harming you, if you had not come quickly to meet me, not a male belonging to Nabal would have been left alive by daybreak. Then David accepted from her hand what she had brought, and said, go home in peace. I have heard your words. I'm granting your request. Mission accomplished, right? I mean, he took the food. He didn't say, you get to go home scot-free. Yeah, I'm going to take my payment. I still got to go feed my men. But understand, not because you gave me all of the food, but because you presented yourself in a way that presented God to me. We're good. We're done. The price has been paid. Now, I'm going to let you finish the story of Abigail and Nabal and David. You should go read the ending. It's a really fun ending, and it's got a really kind of a twist when it comes to the conclusion. And you can go read that on your own time. I want to kind of fast forward, because remember, in this series, not only are we looking at donkeys, we're connecting this to Easter. I've now jumped a few thousand years in history here, and now we are looking at Matthew chapter 26, verses 36 through 46. We are in the garden. Then Jesus went with his disciples to a place called Gethsemane. And he said to them, sit here while I go over there and pray. He took Peter and the two sons of Zebedee along with him, and he began to be sorrowful and troubled. Then he said to them, my soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. Stay here and keep watch with me. Going a little farther, he fell with his face to the ground and prayed. That's a position I've seen recently. My Father, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me. Yet not as I will, but as you will. Then he returned to his disciples and found them sleeping. Couldn't you men keep watch for me for 1 hour, he asked Peter. Watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. He went away a second time and prayed, my Father, if it is possible for this cup to be taken away unless I drink it, may your will be done. When he came back, he again found them sleeping because their eyes were heavy. So he left them and went away once more and prayed a third time, saying the same thing. Then he returned to his disciples and said to them, are you still sleeping and resting? Look, the hour has come. The Son of Man is delivered into the hands of the sinners. Rise! Exclamation point. He said that a lot louder than I did. Here comes my betrayer. I submit to you, this may be one of the very bravest moments in Jesus' ministry, because his moment, it has arrived. He was about to be physically crucified. I remember a few years ago this movie came out, The Passion of the Christ, and they tried really hard to depict the physical brutalness of what it meant to be crucified. They fell short because they were just acting. Jesus was about to be crucified. And from a spiritual sense, He is about to become the face of sin in God's eyes, even to the point in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 21, Paul says this: God made him who had no sin to be sin, not to represent sin, not just to kind of act the part out, to be sin for us, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. And understand, to do this, Jesus was going to have to be both strong and courageous. I mean, we know he's absolutely going to have to be physically strong. I mean, although the disciples got a little catnap in, Jesus is about to spend his night sleepless. We don't think about that enough when it comes to this crucifixion thing. When Jesus actually starts that day, he had been up the entire night. Now, I want you to think about yourselves for just a moment. If I was to keep you up all night long, I might be okay, at least for one night. How alert, how physically strong are you? When your body hasn't rested, you begin to become weaker. And he had been up all night long. And it's not like he'd been sitting up eating popcorn, watching movies. Absolutely not. He would have been beaten and then forced to carry his cross. When they got to that hill, he would have been nailed to the cross, and there it would have taken every ounce of strength he had just to get a breath, as he would have been forced to place his back against that cross, push up on those nails, straighten his legs in order so that he can take a breath in, and then he would have to relax back down because his muscles would not be able to hold it. That's a lot of strength, guys. He had to be physically strong, but he also had to be kind of emotionally strong. It's interesting that he started off this speech by saying, I'm overwhelmed. I'm sorrowful. His heart was being purated, not just by being crucified, by what was about to happen to his friends, so to speak. By the time this would be over, he would be betrayed by one of his own. He would actually be denied by one that is sitting there in the garden with him. And he would be abandoned by all of the others except for one who showed up at the cross. Where were all the others? They were hiding because they were afraid. And as Jesus is hanging from the cross and he's looking out, he doesn't see any faces that have declared, you are the Messiah. Instead, he sees those that are mocking him. They're being condemned, but they're saying, who are you? He's looking out and he's seeing the people that he actually came to die for, her curses and insults at him. His emotions were probably as frazzled as his body was at that point. But what about his mental state? Well, Jesus was going to have to be mentally strong and courageous also. This is what it said, going a little farther. He fell on his face to the ground and prayed, my Father, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me, yet not as I will, but you will. Jesus was willing to go, but I don't think he was happy about it. Jesus was not having a crucifixion party the night before saying, yes, today's the day. No. He's looking out across the next 24 hours at what's going to be happening. And it says he fell before his face. He fell on his face before his God, before his Father. And he says, if you have a plan B, sign me up. You realize that's what that prayer is, right? If you can think of another way to do this that doesn't require me to go to the cross, I am willing to listen to what you have to say. Because you know what? I'm drained. This was the mission, but I'm standing there at the beginning of the end. He just felt anguish. He would spend his final night on trial, being accused and questioned by those, and he didn't even make one single misstep. And as much as the physical strength and the emotional strength and the mental strength is important, you understand, ultimately, this is how Jesus endured the cross. He was spiritually strong. Matthew chapter 27, verse 46 says, about 3 in the afternoon, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, Eli, Eli, lema sabachthani. I practiced pronouncing that this week, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? You know what? I don't think we actually will ever actually understand what happened on the cross. You know why we don't understand it? Because thanks to Jesus being strong and courageous for each of us, we never have to endure it. You get that, right? Because Jesus did what he did, because he made his sacrifice. I will never be asked to make that sacrifice provided I place my life in his hands. It doesn't mean we're not going to face hard and difficult times. But it does mean we never, ever, ever have to face hard and difficult times alone. Because Jesus says, never will I forsake you. So I guess the question I'd like to ask you today is, will you follow the donkey? Will you choose to represent our God with strength and courage? Will you walk the path that Jesus walked? Will you take yourself to the cross in a form of humility and bow yourself down before him and say, you know what? I have nothing to bring you. I don't have a parade of donkeys to bring you with all of the stuff. But I can bring you my life. And I'm going to surrender my life to you, Jesus. Because you're not King David, as we discussed last week. You're King Jesus. And I choose you to be my king.